You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Carlos Billenborg about art and architecture. Carlos, thanks so much for being with me today.
Well, Brainerd, it's a pleasure, and I highly respect all the work that you've done already previously, so I'm very honored to be part of your list.
I'm excited to talk about your work, the different kinds of projects you've done, but to start, I'd like to talk about artist studios that you've made, and those I've been kind of pouring through images of that you've created in different places. So first I want to talk about perhaps a renovation, I think it was in Bridgehampton that you did, where it was an old Frank Stella studio. And could you talk a little bit about that, how that project began and evolved?
Well, all these projects evolved because I have a personal relationship with the artist, and because I think I am an artist, although most people think architecture is not art, and in some ways it isn't, because architecture is a useful object, and art.
If I can stop you there for a minute, I think I also think architecture is art. Artists that I know in the visual arts tend to look up to architects, admire them, and the perspective is that, you know, they aspire to that kind of thinking, and that it is art. Visual artists, you know, think that poets are really also really the art, and they can't say they're poets. So there's all this different mediums seem to, you know, question there whether they're actually in the art world or something. But I think in terms of the visual arts, architecture is. But sorry to interrupt.
Well, yes, and that's the way it was in the Renaissance. It was called the mother of the arts. But it's not the common perception these days, sadly. But in any case, to get back to the subject of an artist studio, it's something that I'm highly concerned with, because I believe this is the place of production of art, and for the most part, some artists don't believe in studios anymore. But I think that as an architect, I'm very interested in the problem. And as each artist develops their own method of working, their studios differ. In this case, this particular artist acquired an industrial building adjacent to the Long Island Railroad in Sagaponack in Long Island, and it was used for storage of potatoes that then shot directly into the railroad car above. And this was a studio that had been used for many years by Frank Stella, and Frank Stella had put in these fantastic skylights. And because it was meant to hold a very heavy weight of potatoes, the whole structure is actually steel, so it's a very, very strong structure. And this artist was working in this place, but had a problem with not so much with the production of the art, because that was beautifully done already by Frank Stella, and that space I didn't do much with, but all the living area of the space, so the a space for his collection, his library, his bedroom, and his bathrooms is something that was a challenge to incorporate into the studio, and we worked together, and of course with artists you have a very low budget, so you have to be very precise in what you do, and here we decided to basically, since there wasn't a possibility of having light introduced from windows, we made these perforations up in like chimneys through the roof, and have basically a series of penetrations from the roof down to bring light into the new spaces that we created. And that was a very fruitful and nice collaboration.
So that is exciting, and you are really, you know, it sounds like it's growing out of a relationship with you and the artist, as you put it. But also, you know, it's always interesting to me that you have to work in such a strict budget. Like you said, artists don't have that much money. But what does that mean exactly? I mean, to me, it seems and this is, you know, my kind of layperson's point of view, if you're having an architect like you design a studio, of you have to be prepared to spend some kind of money. Maybe you're not a multimillionaire, but you're also you know, running a firm that requires, you know, money. You're not a you know, a poet living off thin air, right?
No, they have to pay for my services, but I often take payment in kind, so I take art as payment. I designed a studio for the artist Marisol in a little village close to Caracas called El Hatillo, a very nice colonial village, and this was in the 80s, and there we had to basically reconstruct this colonial little modest house and make it into a studio that she ended up using for about 10 years. And so in that case, she offered to make a portrait of my daughter, who was 4 years old at that time. And so I have a sculpture by Marisol of my daughter. So I don't...
That's quite incredible.
I tend to work with artists in that fashion, so that they basically pay for my draftsman's time, and they know that I'm interested in their problem and ready to solve it, because I began my life as a painter, and so I understand painting specifically, and my wife happens to be a sculptor, so I've also designed a studio for her. Or work with her to make a studio, and so this is art and architecture for me is really not exactly the same thing, but it's certainly a very fluid interchange of ideas.
And let's talk a little bit more about Marisol's studio. How is that approached, and why was that a success, do you think?
Well, it was a kind of romantic thing. She wanted to kind of spend time out of New York City in this little village where she was friendly with all the local bums there who like to hang out at the bar and start drinking beer at 10 o'clock in the morning. And one of these bums was actually called Pinocchio, and he was the builder. So it was a very interesting
process. Pinocchio was the builder. That sounds like a romantic beginning.
Yes, and there she began work on a major sculpture called El General, which then became a cast bronze edition of three monumental sculptures. And in that studio, as she tended to do, she starts with a drawing on the wall, and then from the drawing on the wall becomes the sculpture. And of course, there's a relationship between the light and the wall and the scale of the work.
And that succeeded. You felt very good about that project. I mean,
she enjoyed it, and until basically she didn't want to go to Venezuela anymore, because she's also a New Yorker like me, and sold it, and now people say this is the house where Marisol lived, and it's become some sort of shop or something.
Right. So let's talk about a project that didn't succeed on some level, because, you know, we talked a little bit off the record before the interview about projects, you know, some things fail, some things succeed.
Well, this one was another I came up with an old friend who was also a sculptor, and he has a Victorian house in Bridgehampton, very close to where my house is, and so we're neighbors, and we had an idea of taking the top of the Victorian house's little pitched roof and cantilevering a very long steel beam that goes all the way to the top, and in that space then making a kind of greenhouse as a transitional space between the Victorian house and the studio, and that I think was a very strong concept. And in the end, Well, as sometimes happens with artists, is that they want to have full control of the art. And the, in this case, the artist said, listen, I thank you for your work so far, and I'm going to steal some of these ideas, but I want to develop it further. So that's what happened. I don't consider that a total failure. I have a much bigger failure than that, which a much more interesting failure. And this is a very complex story, because I had for 17 years an office in New York and one in Caracas. And the one in Caracas tended to do very large-scale projects or larger-scale projects, and the one in New York is more small-scale. And this was a 250-room hotel on a promontory overlooking the city of Valencia, and it was for an airline company that was going to have their hub in the city of Valencia, and this was going to be the major hotel and convention center in the city of Valencia. And it began construction around 1996, and around 1998, Chavez was elected, and in 1999, this company was expropriated. So the building is actually there. It's built, let's say, 80%, and now re-inhabited by deers and bats and vegetation, and somehow because in Venezuela it often happens that these abandoned buildings become places of habitation for poor people. No, this building is still empty because the police goes there and keeps it clean somehow. So there is an owner, and we don't know exactly who he is. But the interesting thing is that this place has now become a kind of mecca for people who practice the sport of parkour. So they jump from one edge to the other on these structures, and they send me these videos of it, and it's quite fun to see. But that is truly a failure, because this was a place that was designed, and I worked with actually Roberto Burle Marx from Brazil, the landscape architect, to do a whole pavement and in a very beautiful site overlooking the most important industrial city of Venezuela, Valencia. And I hope one day this construction will be socially inhabited, because of course architecture needs to be inhabited for it to exist. So it cannot be empty. A ruin is not architecture.
It's just that's kind of a fascinating story, really, of that building, the parkour, especially, you know, in a way that also leads to kind of thoughts of how it could be reused, because I've seen some of those parkour videos. My son has showed them to me, and I don't know if it's from your building, but it's usually quite extraordinary athletic feats. It looks like they're doing something that stuntmen should do in the movies, right? I mean, just for our listeners who maybe aren't aware of parkour.
It's unbelievable what they can do. I cannot believe it. They don't kill themselves. I mean, unbelievable.
So tell me a little bit about that, because it's interesting. It's those are people then interacting with your architecture, even though that project, as you're saying, wasn't successful the way you want it to be. A parkour environment is something quite unusual. So can you maybe just tell us a little bit about that video that you saw?
Well, these guys sent me these videos, and they say, listen, we love your project. It's the most fantastic place. and it is some sort of new social use that, of course, was not intended. But at least I'm happy some people are enjoying it, and good things are happening there. So in that sense, it makes me happy. It is a very beautiful structure. If you look at my website, there are pictures of it which are already 10 years old. I want to go back there and make more pictures and see how it's developed. Because it's a very strong horizontal structure, very large. It's all concrete, so it can withstand time without any problem.
That's fascinating. What that must be like to see. Are you documenting that at all? I mean, how does that fit into the Rex? Is this just the past? I mean, it seems it's something you're revisited and reminded of because of those videos, and because you'll revisit it and see it again.
You know, I'd like to document it again because I think it's a very interesting process of building that takes on other lives. And I hope now that it seems like democracy could come back to this military government. And maybe there's hope for the future. Who knows? For it to be what it was intended to be, which was a convention center with a hotel and a major center for the city of Valencia.
You know, that's such a sort of broad way of thinking about architecture. Sometimes I think, you know, how must it feel for architects to see, you know, buildings go up in the, you know, that they've designed, you know, seemingly major buildings in New York City even, and then be torn down to make way for something else that's deemed more interesting. For a visual artist, that would seem like the equivalent of destroying their work to put another painting up.
Curiously, architecture is more fragile than painting, drawing, or sculpture in that sense, because there are always these museums and depositories of the culture that preserve these cultural artifacts. Well, architecture is continuously, for me, it's a good thing. It's part of the city, and the city is always changing and growing. Now, the idea of obsolescence and planned obsolescence is in today's world, I think, a very horrible thing, because it wastes all this energy. It's only possible in an economy of excess. Well, if you have limited resources, you don't want to, you know, tear down your buildings every 5 years. But it seems that the American economy is geared towards that, and maybe it's time to reconsider that.
But to how would you reconsider that? That is a kind of, you know, economy based on a certain kind of capitalistic cannibalism of what was before.
Yes, I think the way you reconsider that is by giving importance to cities. I mean, and not cities as a kind of urban sprawl tied with highways, but it's cities like New York City, which are fairly dense, and yet they're not super dense. I mean, somebody told me recently that if you take the entire population of the world and you take the average density of New York City, including the boroughs, so that means Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, etc., and you can put the entire population of the world with that same density into the state of Texas. So that gives you an idea of how we use space in the world, and how it's not.
That's an incredible idea. That's something I can actually visualize. That's quite incredible.
Yeah. So let's think about cities in that way, and of course think about transportation systems in that way, and I think, you know, I think with the advent of another economy that's not based on petroleum and coal and monocultures like corn, we can think of agriculture in a different way. We can think of urban life in a different way, and I'm very excited by that.
I'm excited by that too. What would be an example of that? I mean, New York, in a way, is evolving to some degree, and maybe, you know, devolving in other ways. Like the, you know, Bloomberg brought in all this kind of wonderful, the bike system and the open spaces. What do you think about all of that?
Yeah, no, I think that's really a good thing that Bloomberg did, and a bad thing that he did was create these huge luxury apartment buildings that really are not housing. If you think of them, they're empty all the time. So they're more like banks. So people who are afraid of investing in stocks or other financial instruments, they invest in these buildings as space. Space becomes an asset which is tradable. So in that sense, Bloomberg has taken the city out of the city with these huge projects in around 57th Street, etc., and in other places, these very large developments actually threaten the cityness of New York City. So at the same time that he did good things about the ground transportation, and really nobody has really thought about the infrastructure of New York City since Mayor LaGuardia. I mean, I don't think anything has really been done. It's all been a series of patchworks.
But don't you think the bikes and all these new little open spaces from Times Square to different areas is also a kind of reworking of the city?
Yes, and I think that's a very positive thing. But it's a very small gesture.
So what would ideally happen to New York? How do you think New York should grow as a city?
Well, I think I think Manhattan is pretty grown up, and if since I moved here in '68, I've seen incredible transformations of Manhattan. And although the buildings may stay the same, for example, like Soho, one thing is when it was light manufacturing and selling cotton duck on Broadway and or skins on Spring Street. And another thing is when it became the center of the art world and all the galleries were here. And now it's back to its actually in the 19th century, it was this central shopping center. So now it's back to its old use. So in a way, the architecture stays the same, but the city changes. And that's been a very positive thing, I think, the whole renovation of the old buildings and the repopulation of Brooklyn, that was once one of the largest cities in America, has now grown. So that's been a very positive development. I would like to see that spread out into the Bronx, for example. The Bronx is huge, and it's the only way out. Where, you know, the rest is basically a dead end. It's all Long Island. And so I think the city should grow northwards.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. In closing, I'd like to talk about one other project that you're looking forward to or currently involved in. Could be a future project that you're thinking about or current project that you're involved in that's of interest at the moment that perhaps you could share with us.
Well, I just finished a house for another artist friend, a photographer, within the village of Sag Harbor, and I found that a very interesting thing because Sag Harbor has the largest collection of 17th century houses in all of America. So I was very interested in making a wooden house, which was very modest, very efficient and economic, and yet somehow captured the spirit of the place, of the village of Sag Harbor, without being imitative in any sense. And I think that project was successfully completed. My client had a party, inauguration party on Halloween. And so that's one very recently completed project that I'm very happy with. Now I'm working on a very large-scale project in the Caribbean, and actually two large-scale projects, one in the island of Jamaica and one in another island, and those are currently what I'm working on.
That sounds very interesting. In the Sag Harbor house, how do you approach dealing with 17th century houses and trying to build something new at the same time? That does sound like a tough context to work with.
Well, the house that was on the site, there was a little house on the site, it was a little ranch house, and we got the permit to demolish it. So I didn't have to deal with a 17th century house. No, I'm using the 17th century houses that they have there as a kind of inspiration because they're very, very clean, geometrical houses that had very efficient use of energy and low spaces, et cetera, and fireplaces. And so I'm inspired by this very sophisticated architecture that was, pioneering at that point. Sag Harbor, of course, grew more in the 18th century when it became the center of the whaling district, and there is when you had 100 of these extravagant churches being built there. But the initial houses there are the 17th century houses, and it's wonderful that these wooden houses are still preserved and you can see them.
And so when you are getting inspired from them, as you say, in the geometry of them,
is there certain proportions back then that were very different? Is that what you mean? And if so, what is that? Is that the width of walls or the pitch of the roofs? I mean, I would think 17th century thing is a kind of a there's some kind of standard way of building or standard proportion or
right. They were all basically cut from the trees around, so the oak trees would be cut and hand sewn, and yes, but what is interesting is that the geometry of these houses is very pure. They're Platonic in certain ways, so you have pitches of roofs that are 45 degrees or asymmetrical pitches, and where you have a towards the north one pitch and towards the south a more gentle pitch. So you're thinking about using the roof as gathering energy actually through the cedar shingles. So yeah, and then the location of the chimney in the center of the house, and then where the chimney is then shared by the kitchen and other things. No, these houses have a very sophisticated and very complex internal arrangements within this geometry, and also beautiful and elegant staircases that are exactly ergonomic in the sense that they fit your hand and your body perfectly, so it's very easy to go up and down. So in that sense, I'm inspired by the these early houses much more so than I am by the 19th century houses.
Carlos, in it's been wonderful talking to you. The listeners of this show are from different parts of the world, but also New York. And in closing, is there anywhere you want to point people to? They could either be seeing to see works of yours that may be public or anywhere.
Well, actually, there's one thing in Bridgehampton that everybody should visit, which is the wonder. It's an old Baptist church right in the village of Bridgehampton, and it is part of the Dear Art Foundation, and it is perhaps the best installation of Dan Flavin's work that you can see anywhere. And that is in a 19th century Baptist church in the middle of Bridgehampton. And the best way for you to see my work is to go to my website. I don't know if I can say it online, but I mean,
the website will be included in the links of this,
okay,
of this interview.
Then I think that's the best way to look at my work.
Carlos, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, Brainerd, and I'll be an avid listener of your future programs.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.